Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new Contemporary Lifestyle Radio Show for Women Over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. Hi, and welcome. Today we'll be talking with a professor, advocate, author who has spent a lifetime studying non-traditional families and the changing mores of the American family. Stephanie Kuntz teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She also serves as co-chair and director of public education at the Council on Contemporary Families, a nonprofit, nonpartisan association of family researchers and practitioners based at the University of Texas at Austin. Her work has been featured in many newspapers such as the New York Times, as well as scholarly journals such as the Journal of Marriage and Family. She is frequently interviewed on national television and radio and has authored more than 5 books during the past few decades. So welcome, Stephanie.
Well, thank you, Sima. Nice to be here.
So tell me a little bit about your interest in this subject, some of the work you've accomplished, and why is this a passion of yours?
Well, I'm old enough to have been raised in a very traditional university setting, to be educated there, where we studied wars and diplomacy. You know, I was a historian. And I gradually became interested in what was happening to parts of the populations that weren't talked about, the ordinary people who had to fight the wars, the women, the African Americans, working class Americans. So I began, as part of the civil rights movement, actually, learning about black history and women's history. And then when I began teaching at Evergreen State College, I was asked to write a book on the history of women. But, you know, this was early 1970s, and there were a lot of books being written about either what's been done to women through the ages or what women have done what some women have done in spite of it. And I wanted to look for a way of bringing women and men into interaction. And back then, it was kind of hard to find places like that. You know, they still had huge occupational segregation and politics. And it was like, the family. So I spent a long time researching family history. And then when I looked up from that, I realized that in the years that I'd spent writing my first book on family history, family had become a really hot topic. Only very few people knew very much about it, and there were a lot of myths written about it and told about it. And as families changed, there was a lot of panic, there was a lot of scapegoating and blaming, and a lot of romanticizing of the past. So I wrote my first popular book, which was called The Way We Never Were. Leave It to Beaver was not a documentary. And that's what made me increasingly interested in and passionate about this subject, that yes, families face tremendous challenges today, and they, you know, they don't always rise to them. But this idea that it's because they've abandoned traditional values, or that we could just go back to some family forms of the past, that seems to me just a recipe for further disaster. So that's my passion.
I'm always working within the zeitgeist of these times. I think that these are fascinating yet incredibly turbulent times. There's so many spokes of the wheel that contribute to what has become an amalgam of family units. So let's talk a little bit about the rise of what I think is the non-traditional family. I'm guessing you're going to tell me it's been going on a lot longer, but I see it here as a steady decline of what the experts would call a traditional family. That would be the 2.5 kids, a white picket fence, the husband and the wife, to what it is today. What are your thoughts about that?
The first thing is that through most of history, there's been all sorts of diverse kind of families. And so when people talk about the traditional family, they are actually talking about a very untraditional family, the male breadwinner family, the nuclear family, that predominated in the 1950s in the post-war era. For most of history, there were all sorts of different forms of marriage, you know, from polygyny to ghost marriages. There was no such thing as a male breadwinner family in most cultures, and certainly in most populations of a culture. In colonial America, wives were called yoke mates because they were recognized to work right alongside the men. And it wasn't until the 1920s that their majority of children grew up in a home where the man earned the wages, and or they weren't working outside the home and the wife was staying at home rather than working outside herself or helping to run a business. So in the 1940s and 50s, right after World War II, you got this extraordinary, unique, historical aberration. And that is what I think frightens people so much, because it's true that when you compare things to the 50s, it's incredibly different. 50 years ago, 70% of adults aged 25 to 29, 90% of women that age were married, compared to only a quarter that day. The proportion of households that had just one person was 13%. Unmarried couples were less than 1% of all households. There were only 35 divorced people for every 1,000 married people. If you went around door to door and chose 100 children at random, 65 would have been living in a family with married parents where the father was employed and the mother was out of the labor force. Only 18 would have had dual earner parents. You would only find one child in every 350 living with a never married mother. So you can see that today, you know, it's a tremendous shock to people who incorrectly think that that was a traditional family. Today, 22 kids of 100 live in a married male breadwinner family. That's less than actually live with a single mother. 7 out of every 100 live with a parent who cohabits with an unmarried partner. The largest group of children, 34, live with dual earner married parents, but that's only a third. So there's really no typical family anymore. And we've also had a lot of changes in immigration, in mixed race couples, the proportion of gay and lesbian families. It's hard to know how much it's actually increased because, of course, they had to remain in the closet for so long. But today there's not a county in America that doesn't have same-sex couples who are out of the closet. So these changes are very disturbing to people who have been raised to emotionally expect only one kind of thing from one kind of family, and to policymakers who have only organized their school schedules, work schedules, and social welfare policies on the basis of one kind of family. But, you know, the good thing about that is that those things never worked for many of those families that even seemed to look like that. Those families were not idyllic. They could not always stand on their own two feet. So in a sense, the diversification of family life has offered us a window into recognizing that every family has distinctive strengths and distinctive weaknesses, and we should address ourselves to those instead of pretending that there is some kind of magic family form that would protect people from the challenges of the modern world.
I think what you just shared is really surprising to me on a number of levels. First of all, what used to be and what is now. In both instances, I'm surprised by the numbers that you provided. But I also think that for a lot of people, same old makes them feel safe. And that this lack of same old or this lack of a traditional moray must be very frightening to people who are always looking to balance the seesaw, if you will. This can be really disconcerting to people. How would they know who to follow? How can they make decisions for so many people based on their own needs and wants and desires? That's frightening for people. Would you agree?
Well, I think it is. I think that people do like the idea that there's one set of one instruction manual that we can follow, and the downside of that, of course, is that that instruction manual often didn't work. I've interviewed women and men who grew up in these 1950s and 60s families or who were actually parents then, and there was so much hidden misery there. Yes, you know, if everything worked fine, it looked great from the outside, but there was no place to escape if you were the victim of abuse or you had drinking problems or incest. All of these things were covered up. Domestic violence was actually much more common in the 50s than it is today. Infanticide was higher. So there's the relief, the good side of having to confront the fact that there are no magic answers, no three rules that some guru can give you, is that we begin to understand the complexity of real life and actually work to change it and to find out what works for every family rather than just give them these good-sounding pablum things that really don't work. But yes, I think it's frightening. And here's another thing, Sima, that I think makes it particularly difficult for people. And that is that if you look back at the 50s and especially the 60s, there was a different economic and political climate then. And I think some people confuse that with the family forms. Actually, what was different and what made many people feel more secure back in the 60s was that you had much more government investment in jobs and infrastructure. The whole highway building program that opened up suburbia to the middle class and provided jobs for blue-collar workers. a government that had much higher taxes on the wealthy and on corporations, and an economy in which in every economic expansion, the bottom 90% gained the bulk of the economic gains, unlike today when it's the top 10% and even 1% that gains it. You had unions supporting high-paid jobs and benefits. For the first three generations after World War II, young men were earning, by age 25, they were earning three times as much as their father had earned in real wages at a similar point at their own age. And so there was a sense of optimism that has since been turned around. And I think it's very easy for political demagogues to say, well, it's been turned around because you no longer live in these male breadwinner two-parent families. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it's been turned around because you can't live in those families anymore because of deregulation and job loss and all of the things that have really undercut the influence that working people have on government and their leverage over their working conditions.
And that was going to be my next question. What are some of the fundamental reasons for the shift? You're starting to talk about this. Any other reasons that you think deserve note?
You know, I think the changes come from some good reasons and some bad. The bad reasons come because of these economic and political trends that I've been talking about, increasing wealth concentration, increasing power of business. Supreme Court is ruling in favor of business much more than it used to do. You have the Citizens United that allows corporations to just spend as much as they want to get votes. So all of these things have sort of really destabilized these sources of stability in working and middle-class communities. And that's the bad ways in which you've seen families fall apart, because one of the biggest predictors of problems in families and in tension, for example, between couples is not whether they were raised in a one-parent or two-parent family, not what their childhood experiences are, but how much chronic economic stress they are under. That's a better predictor of negative interactions between the partners than any of these other factors. So that has been a source of mistrust, a source of conflict, a source of real ambivalence for people. Now, the other side of it, some of these changes come from good things, that we have rejected the sort of false stability and repression that underlined some of the security, seeming security, of the 1950s and 60s. You go back to the 50s and 60s, and working women, if they wanted to get a job, if a woman wanted to get a job and support herself at all, she had to go to the Help Wanted Female section, where there were jobs for perky receptionists and beautiful secretaries. They could actually say that in those days. Mm-hmm. The pay was really, really low. While men's real wages were rising, women's were falling, were either holding flat or even falling for some of that time. If you were married, you had to have your husband's permission to work sometimes. You had to have his permission to take out a credit card. If you were a homemaker and you divorced, you had no claim on the income he earned. The only thing you could get were reparations in terms of a fault-based divorce, but you had to prove that you were innocent of anything that contributed to the divorce. The fault-based divorce required that you prove fault and you come to court with what the judges called with clean hands. So it's also a period when wives had no choice but to submit to their husbands legally, economically. In fact, the legal definition of rape until the late 1970s was a forcible sexual intercourse with a woman other than your wife. So there were all of these terrible things about these, you know, 1950s sitcom visions of family life that have since tumbled because women have begun to speak up, have wanted to have more choice in their life, have wanted to have more equality. And for a while, that tremendously destabilized families. One of the most interesting things, and contrary to all the predictions that we got at the time, is that the further progress of women's liberation has actually been good for families. Domestic violence has decreased radically since the 1970s. Families in which, whether they're married or unmarried, which men and women share breadwinning and share childcare and housework, report the highest marital or sexual satisfaction, relationship satisfaction. We're beginning to understand divorce rates have actually gone down some, but we're also beginning to understand how to handle divorce, that it's not always a disaster. They always tell you that on average, kids of divorce do worse, you know, and have more behavior problems. One way of breaking that down is that one recent study found that 18% of kids who had experienced a divorce experienced an increase in bullying behavior. 14% had less bullying behavior. The rest, there were no changes. So it's the idea that it's divorce in and of itself that causes these problems, we now know is not true, that amicable divorces, mediation, that these sort of things can make a tremendous difference. So we're learning how to deal with diversity, and I think that what we have to hold on to is that a lot of the problems that we still face are not caused by the changes in family forms, but by the changes in economic and political life.
We're talking today with a professor, advocate, author who has spent a lifetime studying non-traditional families and the changing mores of the American family. That would be Stephanie Kuntz. How has society kept pace with some of these changes in providing social services, mental health services, tax breaks? Do you think society has kept up? And if so, what have they done and what's left to do?
No, society has not kept up. And in fact, the United States has an abysmal record. Back under Nixon, a comprehensive child care bill passed Congress, and Nixon was originally supportive of it, but Pat Buchanan, his advisor, suggested that he would be able better to build a wedge issue separating social conservatives and liberals if he vetoed it as an attack on the family. So back in the 70s, Nixon vetoed a child care bill. Every other advanced industrial nation has gone on to invest in child care that is regulated, that is higher quality, especially the Western Europe and the Nordic countries, which are really advanced there. Then in 1993, we had our first and last work family reform, the Family and Medical Leave Act, that gave people 12 weeks of unpaid leave to deal with family emergencies. The problem, of course, is that it was unpaid, so it becomes a class privilege to be able to take time off to deal with family emergencies or to parent, you know, the early months of birth, and also that it only applied to people who worked in firms with 50 or more, so almost 50% of the population was entirely excluded. Since then, every Western European nation and all around the world have instituted paid leaves. 181 other nations have mandated paid maternity leave. 81 have paid paternity leave. The European Union makes it clear that you cannot be penalized for asking for work-family accommodation, and that if you are allowed to drop down to part-time work, you can't be paid less per hour than you were for full-time work. They have paid vacation days. They have paid sick days. The United States have none of those things. We are just absolutely backward in terms of dealing with this reality of the fact that 70% of American kids grow up in families where every adult in the household holds down a job.
What are some of the factors prohibiting this kind of movement toward what the other countries obviously see more easily?
Well, it's complicated, of course, but I think two things come together. One is our historical reliance on women to take care of social welfare. Far more than European and Nordic and Asian countries, we have this sense that everybody has to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, which is, of course, a physical impossibility. You try it and you'll end up on your butt.
Yes.
But there is this myth that this is how you can do it. And the myth has required us to disguise the inevitable dependence that everybody has and their need for help from beyond themselves by putting it all on women, that women as an act of love and self-sacrifice and natural nurturing will take care of all dependencies, and that will free the men up to take care of the family's wage earning. We know that that's not been true, that it's that kind of arrangement has never saved Americans from poverty and job loss. But there is this very strong sense that if women would just go back and be so self-sacrificing and idealist and nurturing, i.e. don't work outside the home and don't use child care, then we could solve those problems. So that's one part of it. And the other part of it, of course, is that Americans don't seem to understand what every family understands, and that is that you invest in your future productivity. You know, if you and I are part of a family and we get some money, we don't hand it out to every person in the family and say, now go spend that yourself. We say, okay, let's see, should we buy a new house? Should we put this in savings for college tuition or whatever? But what happens when we think about our own taxes and government investments? As a whole section of American population that says, oh, no, 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 we don't need taxes. We don't need to save money for these investments in jobs and infrastructure and education and childcare. We should just give everybody families, you know, little discounts, and they can go out and do what they want. So there's this sort of weird, irrational, anti-family idea that we don't have a social responsibility to invest in future generations and the social capital that they need to thrive.
Do you foresee this changing in the near future or at some point in the next 50 years?
Well, I'm a historian, and we're always very reluctant to talk about the future. But I think that we have a choice about whether that happens or not, and we need to have these discussions out in the open, and that everyone who either goes out and works for work-family policies or votes for them, or even just talks about them at work, in school, with your neighbors, you are helping to move the conversation along and get it past this family values. Like my son, the kayaker, used to say, you're stuck in an eddy just going round and round and round saying, oh, well, if only we had these kind of families, it would work. Well, why don't we have it? Because we don't have these kind of families. You know,
yes.
It's this kind of circular reasoning that doesn't get us very far. So I think we all have a responsibility, whether you want to become a citizen activist, whether you want to become a political leader who works for these things, or whether you just want to become an informed citizen who talks about these things, I think we could move the dial a little bit.
You mentioned before the emergence of civil unions. In terms of the types of family units with adoptive children, same-sex partnerships, blending of step families, is there one or more types of family units which in their emergence has helped catapult things forward? Anything that would impact us sociologically?
Well, there's a number of ways in which these new families have impacted us sociologically. First of all, they forced researchers to go past these big overarching generalizations and look at the real varieties of what works and doesn't work for different kinds of families and different kinds of situations. And we've learned that the differences within each family type are more important than the differences between each family type. So you can't just say, this particular family is going to succeed, this particular family is going to fail because of its form. It's real, it's functioning. And we've learned that there can be successful functioning in many, many different family forms. So that's one sense that it's been positive. Another, of course, same-sex couples, the whole struggle over same-sex marriage has really taught people something about the misuse of social science by people who opposed it and the real possibilities of love that goes beyond traditional categories of biology, sexuality, and morality.
Sure.
And that, in turn, I think, was actually partly enabled by the changes in heterosexual marriage, that as many heterosexuals became more open, less rigid about their gender roles, it became less important to say, well, a husband does this and a wife does this, and so you got to have a man and a woman. All of these things have increased our understanding that it's really what you do inside the family and what kind of support you get from outside the family that counts the most, not what you look like, what stereotype you conform to from the outside.
As a researcher, do you see differences regionally, and also do you see differences with economic levels?
Well, yes. Regionally, there are many, many differences that I don't feel totally expert on. But, you know, you have the rural-urban people who have moved a lot in their life, people who have not, have different outlooks on what the role of family and community is. The economic ones are extremely important, and the educational ones. For impoverished people, one of the big strains is this chronic economic stress we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
For middle-income working people, you begin to see, especially ones who don't have the educational and capital resources to kind of feel confident about making it individually in this kind of on-demand economy, you see a sense that, okay, we have to rely on family and maybe we should rely a little more on traditional gender roles. On the other hand, we're seeing a lot of change in those kind of families. It used to be, for example, that when a wife earned more than her husband, that raised the risk of divorce. And wives are much more likely to earn more than their husbands in the kind of middle working class, lower middle working class. And we find that in the last 15 years, 20 years, that risk of divorce has declined. In other words, this group of people is adapting to the reality of women's important role in the family economics and no longer finding it a source of discord. I think there are lots of variations that we probably don't have time to get into here, but that there's nothing that determines that somebody's going to be reactionary or progressive on family type just because of where they were born or what kind of work they do.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any final thoughts for the listener?
Well, I guess the optimistic part is that we really have learned that every family has vulnerabilities. You know, the married couple nuclear family that everybody thought was so magical really has its own particular kind of vulnerabilities. They can get too tight, the husband and wife can be too tight with each other and not invest in social networks outside the family, which is bad for their own kids and bad for their long-term relationship once the kids go back to school. In fact, a lot of this intensive parenting, I think, may have something to do with the fact that the one place where divorce rates have really risen is among people of 50 and especially over 65. They've shot up as some of these couples have found out that they've worked so hard to get their kids off that they've really neglected their relationship. The other side of the coin and weakness of a traditional two-parent family is that you've got a male breadwinner and a female homemaker who's dependent, and they just grow apart, or the woman has been subordinate most of her life, and then after retirement comes, there is this clash between two people who really have so little in common. So we're learning that there's no family form that is invulnerable, but we're learning that almost any family form can adapt, that step families have to behave differently than first couple married families. They have to be more flexible about boundaries, about rules, about the fact that different families will have different rules because the kids may be moving back and forth between households. They need to be much more flexible about gender roles because the kids have a biological mother. The stepmother shouldn't pretend to be one. The stepfather shouldn't say, oh, I know what men do, I'll be the disciplinarian. So they have to play it differently, but when they do, they can be very, very successful. So I think that's the positive lesson we can take from this, that instead of making these blanket generalities about what your family looks like, let's get down, roll up our sleeves, and figure out what we can do to help every family function better and take advantage of its special strengths and avoid its distinctive weaknesses.
We've been talking today with Stephanie Kuntz, a professor, advocate, author who has spent a lifetime studying non-traditional families and the changing mores of the American family. Thanks so much, Stephanie, for joining me today.
You're welcome, Sima. It was fun to speak with you.
I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. Thank you so much to the listener for joining me today. And until next time, I hope you take care.